And we're joined by Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins. Always a pleasure to have them on with us today with Let's Talk Legal. And Cecil and Wes, good afternoon to you, and thanks for joining us.
Lockwood, today we're going to talk about a rule within the North Carolina Rules of Civil Procedure. And this is a rule known in the law as Rule 11. And basically, it's a sanctions rule. It is a, you know, it is a deterrent, if you will, in parties in a lawsuit and or civil procedure getting a bit out of hand. And so, or out of school, if you will. It's there to keep the parties in a proceeding kind of in check, if you will. All of these very interesting general comments that I'm making. And Wes is going to fill in the details here in a moment. But, you know, there are consequences, Lockwood, to what parties file in the civil procedure of our courtrooms. You cannot get out of line but so far before there might be a rule that brings you back into focus. And so Rule 11 is one of those rules that is going to keep the parties in focus and in line. And so it's a very important thing that we talk about and that we know about, and we recognize it to be that it exists, and there are many times that we have to deal with this particular rule.
I'm thinking, and I'm going to preempt this with a question for you, Wes. This is sort of to eliminate, shall we say, the emotional activities and reactions on part of parties sometimes?
Well, I guess you could put it that way. Probably a more direct way to address Rule 11 and some of the other statutes that we'll mention along these lines is that it is designed to act as a deterrent for frivolous lawsuits. So, I mean, you can kind of imagine that in the world of litigation, you know, if you can just bring a lawsuit for anything, then you can put pressure on someone even though you don't have a good legal claim. You don't have a good legal claim, you file the lawsuit anyway and come up with a far-fetched claim or a far-fetched set of facts and circumstances that maybe are not true, then, you know, that defendant that you've sued is summoned to court. They may be required to hire an attorney and spend money on defending themselves. So the Rule 11 rule and some other statutes that we'll deal with, one of them is called a non-justiciable claim statute. It's very similar to Rule 11. Is designed to, again, act as a deterrent or serve as a deterrent for frivolous lawsuits so that in the event that a frivolous action is brought and the court considers that and after a hearing makes a determination that this action was in fact frivolous, then sanctions can be imposed. In most cases, those sanctions are going to be in the form of cost and attorney fees incurred by the party that is on the other side of the case, that is the one receiving or the defendant in the case that was brought, you know, without merit. So it's really in Rule 11, it's really a two-prong approach, and it's not just the claim, but it's also the facts. And generally, the way that Rule 11 is written is that you either have to bring a claim that is currently recognized in the law or a claim that you believe, based on a good faith belief, would warrant the extension of the existing law. Like, for example, this gets a little bit hyper-technical, but I'll try to make it simple. you know, let's say you have a situation where you believe that the law is ripe for change in the particular facts that are being submitted to you or presented to you by your client, but you recognize that maybe the remedy or the claim that you're trying to make is not directly recognized under North Carolina law. Well, if you make a good faith belief, if you have a good faith belief and you can convince the court of that, that there is, that this needs to be considered by our court of appeals, you know, you can even file an action that you may think will be dismissed at the trial court level, but would be considered by the court of appeals where precedent is established. And maybe the particular situation may be changed by an opinion of the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court of North Carolina when we're talking here about state court, and that would be okay, but you would have to have a good faith belief of that.
Mm-hmm.
The second prong is that it has to be based on good facts. You can't just throw allegations onto a complaint without true factual support. So the Rule 11 rule deals with both the attorney who has filed the action and the attorney's client.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the court could impose those sanctions against the attorney who has brought the lawsuit and against the client who has hired the attorney to bring the lawsuit. But you know, keep in mind that the court may be reluctant to bring sanctions against the party if it's a hyper-technical type of argument that's being made in the complaint, because how would the client know whether that's a valid claim or not?
Right.
You know, so you got to take every situation on a case-by-case basis. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so when a client comes to you, you're looking at a variety of aspects of the concern or complaint or the issue that is shared with you. So you're looking at, you're not just listening to the complaint. You have to then delve into that complaint and say, okay, these are some of the legitimacies or legitimate issues that you have, but there are other issues that may not meet criteria established in the current laws. And then you may determine, well, there may be an opportunity here, if I understand this correctly, to and then say, let's pursue this with the acknowledgement that it may be creating or asking for a precedent. It doesn't currently apply to established law. Am I thinking correctly on that?
Yeah, that's right. And let me, this really gets a little bit hyper-technical, but let me kind of break this down into something that's easy to understand with an example. Let's say that a client or a prospective client comes to us and says, so-and-so passed away.
Uh-huh.
I married so-and-so 10 years ago.
Right.
So, Mr. Collins, Mr. Harvell, I understand that I'm entitled to something as a result of being the surviving spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm entitled to, I understand it's, as we've talked about before on the program, Lockwood, an elective share.
Right.
$60,000 called a spousal allowance. Perhaps an intestate share. I'm entitled to these things. Okay, where were you married to this person?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was married to this person in Virginia. Okay, what county? Okay, whatever county it may have been. All right. Well, let's get a copy of that marriage certificate, mm-hmm. and then we'll go forward with representing you relative to the rights that you have in the state of North Carolina in this estate. There's a threshold issue there, and that is, was there in fact a marriage?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say we do all of our due diligence, and we find no marriage certificate.
Ah.
No evidence of marriage, no indication whatsoever other than what our client told us.
Uh-huh.
we would probably be getting in hot water if we brought claims based on a marriage without evidence of an actual marriage.
Ooh.
Okay? If we brought a claim for elective share, well, if this person says that he or she was married, or I guess she was married to the person who passed away, but no evidence they were actually married, then we would probably at some point in time get into an inquiry by the court about, okay, Mr. Collins, what due diligence did
right.
you undertake?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we contacted the court in Halifax County, Virginia, wherever it may have been. We did a person search. We did skip tracing. We did, you know, we interviewed witnesses, you know. And what did you find? Well, we were not able to find a marriage certificate. Well, Mr. Collins, why did you bring this claim then?
Mm-hmm.
Because our claim said he was married to him.
Right.
Well, that's not good enough.
Right.
Sanctions. So, I mean,
wow.
Some cases, you know, if you're, and I always kind of, in many cases, bring it back to your typical, like, car accident case.
Right.
Well, I mean, if you were in a car accident and the defendant T-boned you and, you know, you were hurt as a result, I mean, that's pretty clear that there's some liability there. So you're just, you're bringing your action. There's no possibility of any type of sanctions there. But if there's an element that's missing here, such as the element in the scenario I just set up, meaning proof of actual marriage, and you bring the claim anyway, that's the kind of thing that the court does not look very kindly upon, and attorneys have to be careful. You have to do due diligence. I mean, you see that in many cases lawyers have to do a lot of workup
mm-hmm.
before they go just file whatever their client says to file. I mean, it could, you know, sometimes, you know, you'd be surprised at the way these things work because, you know, let's say that the marriage was 40 years ago in this situation. Let's say that the recording requirements in the respective county weren't very tight back 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that there is a marriage certificate out there in the world, but upon first contact of the clerk of court in the respective county, or the registry, they can't identify it and find it.
Right.
I mean, sometimes attorneys have to spend hours upon hours digging in all across the United States or in the respective state to find what they need to find to represent their client just to get off the runway. A lot of people don't recognize that.
You know,
but, you know, if we don't do that as a lawyer, we just say, well, it doesn't look like there's there. Well, that's kind of a not doing a very good job for your client.
One of the things I'm thinking about that, Wes, and we may get into this on this issue of Rule 11, has to do with property rights because of old records related to meets and bounds. I want to ask you about that here in a moment. We're joined by Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. We're talking about an issue associated with sanctions. I find this fascinating. You mentioned, of course, marriage certificates, but you've also got instances, for example, with property boundaries and, you know, changes in the meets and bounds of boundaries. I always love that term. Finding and doing deed searches and things of this nature. Would this rule also apply in those instances as well?
This rule can be applied in any substantive area.
Wow.
You know, a lot of times on the program here, we have spoken about kind of the reasonable person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the courtroom, our courts, our judges, our clerks, these are very serious places. These are busy places. These are places where time, there needs to be judicial economy, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The time that a judge spends on a case needs to be valuable. It needs to be focused.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I use that word. And so if a lawyer files something that is spurious, that is that doesn't have appropriate grounds, that has not been properly researched, where facts and circumstances that were readily available but yet weren't looked at, weren't analyzed by the lawyer, then the lawyer is potentially setting oneself up for, you know, this Rule 11 sanction. We are required as lawyers and as parties in a lawsuit to be prepared and to know the facts and the circumstances and the documentation mm-hmm. in and around any kind of substantive area. And if we're just off, in a dark alley somewhere without appropriate research, documentation, et cetera, then this rule could potentially apply. But to answer your question, Lockwood, it can be in any area of the substantive law. Anytime we file anything in the court system, we are subject to the rules of civil procedure. And this is one of the rules in the rules of the way in which cases proceed. And the Rule 11 is there, as I said at the outset of the program, to kind of keep the parties in line and to keep the substantive issues of the case focused and based on some well-principled body of law.
And I mentioned the issue of property rights and things of that nature, because there are many instances where title searches go back literally hundreds of years, and sometimes the record keeping is not as complete. So I'm assuming there's some accommodation to allowing a discourse, debate, if you will, over some issues that sometimes can't be fully defined. That's my description of it. Is that possible?
Right. Oh, absolutely. We've been through lots of litigation over deeds and mm-hmm. old deeds and what's included or not included in old deeds, in potential forgeries of deeds, right. Those type of things. But, in those type of situations, you kind of start with, okay, is there a deed?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're kind of contrast that to the marriage certificate scenario that I laid out a moment ago. Well, in the marriage certificate situation, there's no marriage certificate.
Right.
Okay. So you would be taking a huge risk by filing an action based on an allegation of there being a marriage with no evidence of there actually being a marriage. But in the context of there being, a deed, and there being, a situation where there's a dispute with regard to what property uh-huh. is being conveyed, well, that in and of itself doesn't really send you down the path of sanctions.
Okay.
It may be an action to establish a boundary line. It could be a declaratory judgment action for the court to make a declaration as to what property is actually conveyed by this deed. It could be an action where, maybe under a declaratory judgment action, a referee is appointed. That's allowed under our Rules of Civil Procedure for establishing property lines. But these are all things that, yes, there is an accommodation, that's one way to put it, where the law recognizes remedies when there may be some ambiguity with regard to a deed or some old ancient document, and
right.
we're trying to determine what was made and what was not conveyed. Now, there are some kind of more recent remedies with regard to that outside of the court, because if you've used the property as your own for 20 consecutive years, openly and adversely and notoriously, all the things you have to do under adverse possession, well, you can claim title in that property mm-hmm. even though the deed may be defective in some way through adverse possession, which is, squatter's rights.
Right.
So that cleans a lot of things up. Also, the Marketable Title Act allows you to prove your title. You know, we're getting really into the details here, but after years of a connected chain of title. So let's say that you had in your chain of title, you had an old deed from way back when,
mm-hmm.
and it really had some problems in it with regard to legal description. You know, one of these deeds that runs from the oak tree to the pine tree,
right.
to the stump to the rock that we see sometimes. Well, let's say that there was an intervening deed, you know, that had a much more specific legal description, and that is in your chain of title going back, you know, at least 30 years, then under the Marketable Title Act, then you can prove your title based on this better deed. But, you know, the proof is in the pudding. We have to look at the chain of title in a deed situation. We have to find the evidence of the marriage, you know, in the other situation. And you know, if you have those things and you have a colorable claim, is what they say, a claim that is recognized in the law, and then there are mechanisms that us lawyers know where to kind of put categorize the different areas and how to properly, you know, advance those claims.
We're talking with Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins, and we're talking about the issue of, I'm going to call it boundary setting in court cases, Rule 11. You know, one of the things I was asking about related to boundaries and property rights and things of that nature, Wes, of course, is the renowned situation of Salter Path, which was really basically squatters at the time. And so, yeah, they had to establish some, I guess they had, I'll use the term referees, to establish the meets and bounds, the boundary lines for the properties there. But those are one of those areas where, you know, in some instances, as you initiated in the conversation, the law hasn't been fully identified. That's my description. So there are still those opportunities where a client comes to you and says, okay, I think I've got an issue here or an opportunity, or I say opportunity, but a concern, and you have to go deeper into the potential of, I'll use the word precedent, as well as the existing law. Am I correct on that?
Right. Yes, absolutely. Go ahead.
No, I'm going to follow up. You were going to say, and then I'm going to follow up.
I was going to pivot just a bit and explain, you know, another aspect of this that I referred to a moment ago, which is, you know, Rule 11 really looks at your pleadings, what you filed in court, and whether it's well-grounded in fact, whether it's well-grounded in the law or the extension of the existing law. That's what we look at. And in the event that it's not, and the court makes that determination after due process, meaning notice and a hearing, then there could be sanctions. Another element of that, and there are various areas where sanctions can be imposed. There could be sanctions in a contempt setting, which really are limited as far as attorney's fees. But another area where attorney's fees and cost can be the sanction that the court imposes is under what's called North Carolina General Statute 6-21.5, referred to as the non-justiciable claim. That's a mouthful, non-justiciable claim. And what that is that it's very similar to Rule 11, but you may have, let's say, under a non-justiciable claim, you may have a valid claim when you file your lawsuit. For example, let's say that I file a breach of contract action against someone, and I know that there may be a statute of limitations problem with this. And normally the statute of limitations, meaning the period of time for which you need to bring your lawsuit in a breach of contract, is 3 years from the date of breach.
Uh-huh.
Typically, it could, under certain circumstances, it could go up to 10 years. But let's say that I know that there may be an issue with that. But I also know, as an attorney who practices in this area, that if the responding party, the breaching party, does not raise statute of limitations as a defense in response to the lawsuit, then they've waived it. Because it's what's called an affirmative defense. So I can bring that lawsuit for a breach of contract well within the rules of Rule 11, the limits of Rule 11. But in the event that the responding party files their responsive pleading, their answer, and raises a statute of limitations defense, and I see that they've now raised that, well, I'm then on a good faith, in a good faith belief or good faith understanding should be that, okay, I knew I had a statute of limitations problem on the outset. They've now raised the statute of limitations defense, affirmative defense. That gutted my lawsuit. I need to dismiss and not go any further. Okay?
Right.
There's a particular case called the, referred to as the Sun America case, where that those exact circumstances happened. And after that, affirmative defense of statute of limitations was raised, for some reason, the plaintiff's attorney continued to exercise what they refer to as the machinery of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
Went through summary judgment, made the defendant defend on summary judgment when the court found you should have just dismissed your case. So under non-justiciable claims, 6-21.5, what did the court do? Sanctioned the party for proceeding after he should have known that, that the statute of limitations was raised and you had no further claim. So that's a different area in which sanctions can be imposed.
So you're saying that if you wish to initiate a case, that's one thing, but once you come to clarity or an understanding of the law in this particular case, then you do have the privilege as a client and as my, my attorney to say, okay, we're not going to pursue this case any further. So the sanctions would not apply in those cases?
That's right. If you acted in good faith
and
dismissed once that affirmative defense was raised, then you would not be subject to sanctions because when you filed the complaint, it was a colorable claim.
Mm-hmm.
It did not violate Rule 11.
Gotcha.
But if you don't dismiss it once that affirmative defense is raised, unless, you know, if it's clear that this is barred by the statute of limitations and you don't dismiss it, then you're running quite a risk because our courts of appeals have made it clear that the superior court under that circumstance is well within its rights to sanction if you don't dismiss. So if you go to a hearing on non-justiciable claim and the precedent in Sun America is laid out on a silver platter for the judge,
right,
there's not many judges that will ignore that.
Understood.
They'll do exactly what the Court of Appeals said is proper.
I want to get wrap it up with the, just the issue associated with that of the client. We're seeing the, and hearing the responsibilities of the attorney, but I also want to bring up the issue of the clients in this case. We're talking with Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell, and that was Wes just a few moments ago, of Harvell and Collins. And by the way, just want to remind you, a number to call if you have any interest in this and other items we've been talking about here of late, 726-9050. That's 726-9050. Wes, and Cecil, wrapping it up, we're hearing the responsibility of the attorney, but obviously there are instances when you're dealing with clients who come in very impassioned. They know they feel they have a good case or a good concern. What do you need from the client? I walk into your office. I acknowledge the fact that, you know, the first conversation is no charge. You're sitting down and you're talking to me. But once we pursue this, you're going to need something from the client in order to justify your research into the case as well. So let's talk about the client's responsibility in this case.
Well, Lockwood, absolutely. And I guess, you know, welcome to the kind of, if you will, serious and very stressful side, if you will, of being a lawyer. I have that very situation going on yesterday and today.
And Wes will be helping me with it this afternoon, where there's a family that is insistent. Absolutely. I've spoken to them over the telephone. They right. do not live locally. The matter concerns a local death. Mm-hmm. But they particularly live in Florida, and they are absolutely insistent in pursuing their rights and what they perceive to be their right and right. their remedy. I keep telling them that the law is not on their side right. and why. Uh-huh. And I am very discouraged in having to tell them that. And they just simply will not at this point accept that. Now, of course, you know, ethically, I have not accepted their case. I have intentionally not, as a lawyer, taken on their case, mm-hmm. accepted a retainer from them, Lockwood, because with that would come some responsibility in pursuing uh-huh. their action, which I question whether or not there is any remedy for them, any positive result whatsoever. And so here we are now. We'll continue to discuss it with this client. We'll continue to do as much research as we can. But absolutely, there are times that our client are getting information inconsistent with what they want to hear.